Welcome, movie fans. We are David and Melissa from ThatMomentIn.com. And up next, our review of The Black Coat's Daughter. The Black Coat's Daughter is a 2017 horror film about two girls left behind at their boarding school over winter break who face a mysterious evil. Melissa, this was actually filmed in 2015, and as you probably know, it had a different name at the time. It was called February. Now, it's getting released in a couple of days now in North America as The Black Coat's Daughter. Why don't you give us a little more detail on what this story is all about?
So basically, there's two girls, and as you mentioned, they're kind of left at their boarding school over the holiday, but strange things start happening, and we don't really know what's going on. Yeah, I liken this movie to a puzzle. It kind of has a whole bunch of different pieces,
yeah.
And then towards the end, they all start coming together. It's really a different kind of storytelling than what you're typically used to. And the two girls are staying behind for different reasons. One of them told her parents not to come until mm-hmm. the end of that week.
Mm-hmm.
And the other girl has this strange premonition. She has this dream at the beginning that her parents were in a car accident. So she's thinking that something has happened to them and that they're not coming at all. And so they're in this school and there's no one there besides the two of them, the school nurse, and I think the fourth
the secretary or something.
It's like the secretary. Yeah,
yeah
I was going
right.
to say administrator. Yeah, so it's just the four of them. And it goes from there.
You know, I got to say, I like how you started this. You haven't yet mentioned the word horror or thriller. And those are actually the two words that are used to describe the film, but it is more of a mystery, though it does have, certainly towards the back end, a lot of horror elements and tropes to it. And, you know, one of the things I like best about this film is that the setting is it's an academy, I guess, or it's a Catholic girls' school, right, I guess. But it's never really filmed in a spooky... I mean, yeah, there are moments when the director takes time to make something spooky, but the setting, especially in the exteriors, it's as daylight. You know, it's never filmed in the tropish traditional sense of a, you know, possessed house, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's not playing to those particular tropes or those particular horror movie stereotypes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really just an average kind of story. Like, it could happen to anyone, and it's just, you know, following along as the events unfold kind of thing.
Well, you know, it does this thing where it it also flips a couple of the expectations as well. You mentioned the two girls, so let's introduce them. The younger one, her name is, you know, her nickname is Kat. She's played by Kiernan Shipka. And she's like the newest to the school. She's the one who had the premonition about her parents. And the older one is Rose, played by Lucy Boynton. And she is set up as, you know, like the, like you expect her to be the vessel of the possession, right? And she's kind of a naughty girl. She's lied to the headmaster about her parents, basically. We see her sneaking off and we think that she's, you know, trying to get something on the side with a boyfriend or something. And that doesn't pan out the way we think as well. And we see her set up to be this bad girl, but they really very slowly flip it around on us,
yeah.
And it ends up being Kat. Now, there's a third girl you haven't mentioned yet. Meanwhile, as these two girls are dealing with something mysterious at this school, we meet Joan, who's a bit older, and she's played by Emma Roberts, and she's sitting on the steps of this building out in the middle of freezing cold, and this couple pull up. With James Remar and Lauren Holly, no less, as this couple who offer her a ride. And they're on their way in, or coming near to the town where the school is. And this girl, Joan, she joins them, and she feels that there's like a little bit of hesitancy about this. And, of
yeah.
course, the couple are kind of creepy a little bit. And
yeah.
There's a really interesting dynamic there that plays off the two girls at the school and the couple and Joan on their way to the school.
Right. And you know what? I really like how it plays with those stereotypes of these characters, because right off the bat, when we're introduced to Joan, she's sitting out in the cold, and the father character, he comes and he talks to her, and right off the bat, you're like,
Yeah,
oh,
he's a
young
psycho murderer,
girl,
right?
yeah, young girl, sitting out in the cold, and this older man comes up, and you're thinking, oh no,
No.
like I know where this is going, like he's gonna be some kind of rapist or creeper or something terrible's gonna happen, and so it just plays with our expectations, right? We expect the older man to be the villain, right? And then when he goes into the car and he and the wife are driving along with the Emma Roberts character, you're thinking there's something not quite right with this couple, something's going on. And then later on, he goes into Emma Roberts' hotel room when she's only in a towel, and you're thinking,
Yes.
okay, this is
Okay.
when it's gonna happen, this is when he's gonna try and come on to her, and there's these like really odd subtle undertones, and it really just keeps you guessing the whole way through. And just as you mentioned, the same thing happens with the other two characters, with the first character, the girl who thought her parents had died, Kat. You think that she's just this really sweet, innocent, like naive girl, and it plays with that too. And it's such an interesting journey, really. When everything kind of comes together, you're like, what is happening? And it's such a good surprise.
Yeah, let's not spoil it. I know you're not going to, but let's not spoil it because there is a pretty decent twist here. And as the film is not quite released yet, it's coming out in a couple of days. Let's just stick to the fun parts here. And I gotta say that it's written directed by Oz Perkins. Now, that's a name that you probably don't know, but Melissa, of a month or so ago, maybe a little more than a month ago, on the site, I reviewed a film called "I Am the Pretty Things That Live in the House," which is a
Yes.
Netflix film, and it is from the same guy, same writer and director. And off mic, you and I had a discussion. I praised that film. I really, really liked that film. And you and I had talked about it and saying that you had not
No,
liked the
yeah, I did
film.
not
You don't
like
like the
that
film.
movie. No.
Now I'm really interested because we're halfway through this podcast, and you clearly really enjoyed The Black Coat's Daughter. And I've been thinking about it in anticipation of this. And you had mentioned, and I'm going to voice what you had said to me, and I'm paraphrasing. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of your criticisms about "I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House" was that it was all set up and no payoff.
Right.
And here, there's a lot of payoff, including gore and some violence and some scares that were set up, but you felt were absent in the other film. Is that why
Right.
you're steering
That's
more to?
exactly it. You know what? I still appreciated what he was going for in the other movie, and I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. I appreciated like the feeling, the atmosphere, the kind of sense of dread that, you know, was kind of permeating through the whole movie, but there was no payoff. It was almost like he was playing with us. Like he was saying, okay, well, I know what you came here for, and I'm not going to give it to you. Whereas this movie, he gives it to us. Like there are some truly, truly scary moments. Some moments where I was catching my breath because I was really unnerved by them. And I see a lot of these movies, so I saw this movie and I was thinking to myself, you know, there's only maybe a handful, I'd say definitely less than like three or four movies a year that really kind of like get to me and that I get really excited about, and this was one of them. And I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House had the potential to be that kind of movie too. So I think this director has a lot going for him, but the other one, it just, there was no, you know, there was no end game kind of thing. It was like he's just leading us along the whole time, and then nothing happened.
Okay, I can see where you're going. And the thing is, with Perkins, the director, I feel like he's doing a variation of the same theme. And what he does, he's clearly a master at. And maybe he's playing to two different audiences with these films is a sense of atmosphere. You know, for me, I'm the Pretty Things That Live in the House. I really got drawn right into the potential, and I wasn't upset by what you feel is no payoff. I really felt the payoff was there, but in a different way. And you know what he does, and you know, back me up on this, is like, this guy can turn his camera on to just about any inanimate object and just fill it with absolute dread. I mean, we had looking at the vent on a floor, that, you know, he just got the camera on a vent on a floor for just a half a minute, you know, 30 seconds. And it's just terrifying because you don't know what is coming, what is in the shadows. And yet there is a pervasive sense of dread while you're in a lot of parts of the film. But again, I think he works really hard and does a good job of stripping away the expectations so that, like, when you are out of those moments, it's daylight and you're walking around and she's out, you know, shoveling snow, and that dread is not quite there anymore. And so I really feel like the sense of place feels much more authentic because of, you know, these houses and buildings and schools that we see populated in the other tropish horror movies all seem disconnected from reality, whereas this one did feel very connected to reality.
It did. And you know what I think is the main thing that works for Perkins is that he makes us pay such close attention. Like, other movies, our attention kind of drifts, but it seems like every single word that is spoken, every single shot that is taken is purposeful. Like, it's important. There is weight to it. And so, like, you need to pay attention if you want to figure out what's going on, because it is kind of a mystery and you're trying to keep up and figure out how the pieces fit together. And it really demands so much of your attention. Like, you look away for a minute and you come back and things sort of don't make sense, and you kind of have to rewind and revisit what you kind of missed in just that small period of time. Whereas some movies, you can kind of, you know, play on your phone or get distracted or go get a snack and come back and you're like, oh yeah, they're still doing whatever. But this movie, like, every component fits together and they're purposeful and they have weight.
Agreed. And I think what really works well too is this director never relies on the jump scare. And what he does is he tweaks that string, and he's playing with that string of the jump scare, but he never lets it happen. And I think that is just so unnerving while you're watching the film, because we're primed for, okay, there's the shadow, something's going to jump out, but it doesn't happen in the sense that we expect it. And I think he understands that, and he does it so well. We're not going to give anything away, but there are a couple of truly scary moments when something does appear in the peripheral and in reflections and things. And I'm going to bring up one of our favorite movies in this genre, and that's The Babadook. And I feel like I could draw a line between these two films in, at least with that aspect. I think I know, you know what I'm going with this. And
absolutely. And,
now, that said, I want to get into just a couple of minor tweaks, and I want your opinion on this. I felt, again, that maybe 3/4 of the way through, a revelation is made in a diner that I think was made too early. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. I could see that. I could see that. However,
Just let the audience know. Let listeners know that there's a moment when two people are talking and a photograph is shown to one person, and the photograph reveals something that that is part of the mystery, and it answers that mystery. But it happens with a good 35 minutes left in the film.
And I
felt like, and the whole time it was happening, I was like, please don't show us the picture. Please don't show us the picture. Please don't. And then he showed the picture. And at that moment, for me, I knew exactly who Joan was.
Yeah. Do you know what, though, is funny? I did, too.
Okay.
Right away, I was like, oh, my God. And I had that moment. I was like, oh, my God. But I was watching it with someone else, And so I'm like keeping it all in.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, I don't want to ruin it for this other person. And I look at them and they're like, oh, but what's going on? Does he think something happened to her and it didn't happen to her? Didn't realize what was going on until later. And then the pieces all fell together and they're like, oh, how did I not notice that right away?
And it's so interesting too, because Perkins, not to interrupt you, but Perkins took, what was it, three times when he had another the character in the picture show you that picture being taken.
Now,
in lengthy, in like, you know, the sequence of this is happening. And so for me, it was like not so much pounding on the head of the nail so much, but I, you know, you are a big fan of the genre. And I'm curious about your feelings about this twist reveal so quick. Do you think that it supported, did it give it better weight to the ending to make the ending? Do you think it made the ending more understandable?
Do you know what? I see exactly what you're saying, and I would like to see the alternate version is revealed later on.
Right.
But at the same time, I kind of like it, because I'm going to keep going back to the analogy of this movie being like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And so that piece fell in, and it's a big piece, but there's a whole lot of other pieces that still didn't really make sense yet.
Yes.
And so it was kind of like that was the kind of boulder that's going over the cliff, and now all all of the other smaller pebbles are kind of falling in after it, kind mm-hmm. of thing. So mm-hmm. I still wouldn't say that that was a bad choice. I still liked it. And different people are going to be catching what that means at different points. Even though I caught it right away, and I feel like most people probably would, it still leaves you with so many questions.
Right,
and it almost makes you more invested, because you're like, oh my goodness. So that means A, B, and C is going to happen, but you know, I really don't feel like they're leaning towards this happening. So how is this going to unfold?
Right. Yeah.
So do you know what? I would like to see it with that twist being revealed later on, but it's such a strong choice too, because so oftentimes we watch these movies and then at the end they throw the twist in at you and they're like kind of discrediting a lot of the rest of the movie.
Okay. Sure. Sure.
Whereas in this case, they kind of throw that in there and it kind of adds another layer of questions to it. For me, at least. And you mentioned the part about her getting her picture taken. And I just want to take a quick second and say that I loved those moments. First, when she's first introduced and she goes and she sits in the chair and adjusts herself. And I love at the end when she takes the picture and she's smiling. And then it shows her reaction afterwards, because she's got a lot weighing on her mind at this point. And I always think it's interesting to watch people take pictures and then see their face like 5 seconds afterwards, right? Because I don't know, it's
brilliant. It was really brilliant, because Perkins keeps going back revisiting that moment and adding a little bit more context to it in this slow motion morphing of this person's face that it's heart-wrenching, and especially as you learn more what's happening, and then her fate, of course. The thing is, there is some ambiguity left. There certainly is, and I don't think it's a spoiler to talk about the title as well. The new title, as we mentioned, is called The Black Coat's Daughter, and the original title is February. And I want to talk a little bit about this, because knowing what we do after the film is over, and even going into the film, I felt that the title change, for lack of a better term, is sort of a mistake, because it directly nudges us, I think, towards an expectation of interpretation. Whereas February, and because honestly, if there's a third or fourth, I should say fourth character in this film, it is the pervasive sense of cold and chill and winter.
Yeah.
And I think February is just such an interesting, because for me, and you know how I am, Melissa, I tend to layer things on and on and on metaphorically. And I think that February itself is such an interesting word to name a movie, because it suggests time, it suggests a season, it's a time of you know, death before, you know, the spring comes. There's so much you could pull from just the word February, and I felt like changing it to the Black Coat's daughter definitely steers me towards one interpretation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I like I like the wording, like the Black Coat's daughter. I kind of like how that sounds, just purely from, you know, would aesthetic be the right
word?
I kind of like the feeling that it imbues, but it does, in, you know, turning that on its head, it does imbue a feeling and shouldn't.
Yeah, right.
Prior to us watching the film, should we have any hints that that soon into the movie, right?
Right.
Before even watching it. So just how you just described it, I prefer February as a title. I would say I prefer February. But again, it's not going to make me appreciate the movie less, really.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, getting towards the end of our show here, I really want to get back to Oz Perkins himself. I think this is a director who, he's found a niche, and he's doing really well with this niche. You've seen two of his films now, and you feel opposite about them. Are you interested in more?
But I can tell... Yeah, I definitely am.
Yeah.
And you know what? I've seen two, and I wasn't crazy about the first one, but you know what? I can tell that they're by the same director. They have a very similar feeling, and I still appreciated the sentiment behind I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. I still liked what he was going for. I just didn't like that it was so long and drawn out. And actually, similarly, The Black Coat's Daughter, the first 10 minutes... I was kind of like, what the hell am I watching? Is this another one of those artsy movies that, like, nothing happens and we're just going to be sitting in silence and, you know, there's undercurrents of this and that happening? And then very quickly, my expectation completely did a 180. And I was like, oh my God. I'm gonna love this, right? But the first 10 minutes, I was along the same lines of I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, of, oh God, oh, am I going to be sitting through like another art house film? What's going on here?
I had no idea it was the same director. And it's interesting, like after those first 10 minutes, I was making notes. I was like, this is just like that movie. I'm like, oh wait, I checked it. Oh, it's the same guy. Of course. So,
yeah.
Okay. Let's get to the ending here. What are you going to give? Out of 5 stars, how many stars are you going to give The Black Coat's Daughter?
I'm going to give it 4.5.
I'm going to give it 4. Thanks for listening. For more reviews and daily posts, head on over to our website, thatmomentin.com.